Speaking of famous, Dr. and Mrs. Future should be in the studio sometime about now. If they are, the famous Dr. and Mrs. Future can come on. They're so famous, they don't even have real names. That's famous. When people know you by, like, a crazy name, like Dr. Future, Mrs. Future. And by the way, when she got married, did she know that her name would have to be changed to Future? Did she know? Did she know that?
It wasn't Curry. I'm one of those women who kept my other name.
I'm against it. That's very cool. I'm hoping my daughters do that.
Yeah, I had all sisters, and I'm my father's only son, so I had to keep my name.
I'm the only son as well. So if my daughters don't produce a gold child, there'll be no more gold children. It'll be the end of the line.
Is gold real too? I mean, is that?
Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah, it wasn't like gold. It wasn't like Goldberg Steinstein. No, it wasn't any of those things. We actually looked it up, and gold was the name all along. Somebody got smart very early on in the day.
So were your family goldsmiths way back or something?
You know, I don't know. Somebody in my family should actually take the time to find that out.
Yeah, but hey, listen, there is a drama unfolding right now. Your audience should know about. The space station may be hit any minute.
It passed. It's over.
It did?
Yeah.
Oh, thanks for updating me.
They said the garbage was going to pass 3.5 miles away, and it passed 4 miles away.
Oh, okay, good.
And you know why most of that garbage is up there? Because the Chinese, a few years back, decided that they want to show us that they had a really good technology, and they blew up one of their own satellites, and they created a mass amount of space junk.
Yeah, right in our path there. Doesn't that speak to, like, maybe we should arm the space station? We maybe have air missiles on board or something like that?
Yeah, can we be playing missile command with space junk?
What's that commercial for the vacuum cleaner that doesn't get any clogs, you know, the one, the Bissell, I think it is?
Bissell, the Dyson?
Why don't we get a Dyson or a Bissell or something and just bring it up there and just gobble up all that space junk? Get a gigantic Dyson.
It should be recyclable. It's probably very valuable metal. You know, I mean, how expensive space stuff is anyway.
But they have talked about either blowing up all the space particles or bissling them.
Yeah, you have a point there, Corey. That's a great idea. We should actually put it all in the vacuum and then disassemble it and reutilize it.
Yeah, get a Yank Hoover up there.
There's probably a lot of gold there.
Or actually probably titanium or something,
yeah. Because, you know, when Russia collapsed, one of the big things was to melt down the old computers and get the gold out of them. Because gold was used a lot in high-end electronics for soldering and stuff. So, it could be more valuable than we think. So recycling the space junk might be... And that's a perfect thing for the Chinese part of the space station to do, because they're already doing it to our junk here on the land.
That's right. They can do both, the space and on land.
And make up for this near accident we almost had.
Almost had, yes. 4 miles away.
Yeah.
The spitting distance in space.
Nothing. Yeah, no. I mean, it was a red alert at NASA. They were very concerned.
Isn't that funny? Like, when somebody drives a car 4 miles away from you right now, you're not too worried about it. But if it was 4 miles away in space, you'd be very worried about it. What's interesting is they actually know with really good accuracy where they're going to go, where the orbits are going to take them. I mean, it's amazing how the computers can figure out, it's going to miss 3.5 miles. I mean, they literally know.
Yeah, it is. It's and yet.
Collision detection in space.
Danger, danger, Will Robinson.
Yeah.
So what's up on the Dr. and Mrs. Future show today?
Well, the second hour, we're having Charles Ostman on, who's known as the historian of the future. So we want to see his take on things.
Isn't that kind of like oxymoronic, the history of the future?
I know it is. He's a very oxymoronic person.
Isn't like that's like absolutely everything about nothing?
He's a comprehensive generalist.
It's like, I know everything that hasn't happened. I know everything about things that haven't happened so far.
Yes.
Well, you know, it only takes 1 second to make history.
But then it's history. It's no longer predicting.
He only has to be right once. And it's got to be, good right. And then he justifies all the wrongs. I mean, most of our futurists have been very, very inaccurate. You know, they have less than 1% accuracy. So I'm hoping.
It's like my putting.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of pundits predicted we'd be paying $40 a gallon for gasoline by now.
And they missed it by about 3 months, I think.
You think? You're still going for that, are you?
No, I do think gasoline will get up to $5-6 a gallon in the next 6 months or so.
Yeah, and then people get sick and tired of it and come up with alternatives at that point.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I'm driving a Prius right now, so I feel pretty good about that.
I don't know. You know, we were just recently researching natural gas, and we found that there's some revolutionary new technology coming out that turns natural gas into liquefied gas at about $25 a barrel.
And you can use it in your car. You'd be able to turn natural gas into gasoline.
Things are getting so expensive, I guess you might use a barrel of monkeys.
Yeah, good luck. It sounds like the Flintstones.
And by the way, there is a car working in Europe right now on pressed air.
Yes, I heard about that. It's French.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's full of hot air, so that makes sense that they discovered this.
They might as well harness it, eh? use it for transportation.
But it is. It drives a car on compressed air.
Well, I just found out about a Boulder Creek inventor who claims to be able to create a car that just runs on water. You fill your gas tank with water, and it makes hydrogen on demand. So I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Well, too bad we have a water shortage. Otherwise, that would work fine.
I know. There's always something, isn't there?
Anyway, so what's going on in the first hour?
In the first hour, we have a whole bunch of stories.
You should look at the DrFutureShow.com links page, and then you'll see all of this stuff we're talking about today.
We have
God, you got a page and everything. I'm lucky if I even know what to turn the computer on.
We have some more stuff on the Kinect box, which is kind of interesting. Google did an April Fool's joke where they claim to control your email by moving your hands and in a gesture language where you put your thumb out and it sends the email and you spread your arms apart and it opens up a new one, things like that. And at the end, they tell you it's a joke. This isn't real. Well, some hackers saw this Google April Fool's joke and they made it real using the Kinect box.
April Fool's on you, Google.
For the 360. So we thought that was interesting.
That is cool. All right, the Dr. Mrs. Future Show following, is it the Fox News up here in just about 20 seconds from now?
All right,
make
thanks,
sure you stay
Corey.
Tuned and learn about absolutely everything about nothing in the future. I'll do a cheer or something.
Yeah.
Go.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Time now for What's Left in Dr. Future on AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz.
Good afternoon, everyone. Dr. Future here with Agent Nada and Mrs. Future.
Hello, KSCO land.
Hello, KSCO. Hello, Dr. Future,
hey.
Mrs. Future.
Hey, we do have one more traffic report, Don.
Yes.
And that's that the space station is safe. Apparently, a big piece of junk almost hit it, and it's been avoided.
So we don't have to go around it now.
That's right. We can stay on course.
Divert thousands of miles out of our way.
That's
or have
right.
to think about silly things like putting air-to-air missiles, I guess it would be, on the space station to protect it from future junk.
And everybody who vacated the space station to wait in the safety of their reserve vehicle can get back on board now.
The Soyuz spacecraft docked for emergency purposes at the station. Apparently they had to go there for a while, but they're back out now. So good news on the traffic circuit up in space there.
Woohoo! That was close.
4 miles in space-time. Space distance.
Can you imagine that? $15 billion space station going up in smoke because of Chinese space junk?
Anyway. Well, I'll tell you, I doubt that we'd be saying the nationality if it happened to be our space junk.
You don't think so?
No. There's so much space junk up there, and so many people are guilty of it. I'm sure that we've got our fair share.
I don't blame the Chinese for that.
You don't?
Yeah. Who would have guessed? I bet you they weren't thinking about it when they blew up their satellite back in 2007 that created the space junk.
Well, it's just the way people are. They don't think about their trash when they're creating it.
Or
right?
did they?
Oh, that's it.
Dun, dun.
They carefully constructed an explosion that would send a piece of space junk 2 years later.
Yeah, right.
3 years later.
It was all figured out.
I think they may be capable
give them
of thinking
a lot of credit.
A lot, but that's beyond credit, man. That's giving them supernatural abilities.
Yeah.
Hey, they're Chinese.
Actually, I'm sure if it had hit, then that might have been some conspiracy theory would come up with it.
For sure. I think there's a conspiracy already, and it didn't even hit.
Yeah. It was supposed to hit. We used our force field to divert it, and we just don't want anyone to know because we don't want to start a war.
You know what I think? I think if you think about anything long enough, you can come up with a conspiracy theory.
Absolutely. We're all sci-fi writers at heart, aren't we?
Yeah.
You could certainly spin it any way we want. That's for sure.
By the way, that is the kind of a theme of a new movie that's just coming out this week.
Oh, yeah?
You hear about that? Film preview of Source Code.
Ooh, Source Code. Sounds right up my alley. Tell me about it, Dr. Future.
Well, it's a film that's taking advantage of all the things we've thought about in terms of brain uploads and moving our consciousness into other bodies and things like that. It's all been encoded into this film as a dramatic piece.
Yeah, and there's a lot of ideas that are there from the Kurzweil
mind. Yeah, a lot of the Kurzweil
which
thinking.
We talk about quite a bit. And have the pleasure of having one of the Kurzweil agents here in Santa Cruz County.
That's right. We're very fortunate. And I no doubt a lot of those ideas got directly into source code from the Kurzweil world. I can see that.
So tell us a little bit about the synopsis, Dr. Future.
Well, it's kind of a military drama a little bit. It's the Pentagon has a secret program where they send a pilot back in time to cross over into another person's identity and relive the last 8 minutes of a passenger's life on a train that's destined to blow up. And the mission, from their point of view, is to find a bomb that exploded on the train that killed everyone to prevent another terrorist attack in 6 hours. You can cut the tension with a knife.
And it's got Jake Gyllenhaal.
This is really a new class of soldier, right? The future philanthropist, or what do you call it when someone intervenes in a crisis so that it doesn't happen?
Interventionists,
that's it. Sci-fi spy interventionists.
Well, that's what the whole Terminator sequence of movies was all about.
Yeah, but the Terminator only knew how to explode things. He wasn't intervening to prevent the explosion.
Interloper?
Yeah.
Interloper. Right, but
he's there to interrupt the plot.
But that was the Terminator, but the humans in the story of Terminator are going back in time and trying to...
Yes.
To stop the Terminator.
They are the interlopers.
Actually ever to exist.
That's what I was talking about.
You're right. It's,
but we've evolved
it's
now.
It's all been done before.
You see, the thing today is that we're much more into parallel universes than we were back then, in terms of the popular understanding of space-time.
Really?
Yeah, Terminator was very linear. You go back in time to stop something from happening. It's like going back in time to kill your grandmother so that you're not born. That's ridiculous, because we now know that there are many more, well, we don't know for sure, but we believe that there are many universes and that many simultaneously coexist with each other.
Well, we certainly know that there's a lot more dimensions than the three that we're aware of.
Yeah, and the we that you're talking about, there's many we who believe that there's only one universe. And it's really just our limited perception that prevents us from knowing all of the details.
Well, one for one, I can embrace one universe and the idea of many universes simultaneously. And even though they might seem contradictory, that's part of what we can do as human beings. We can embrace contradiction. We can embrace paradox.
That's right, because paradox is a conceptual mode.
Yeah. I mean, it becomes real, though, when you actually embrace supposedly opposite things.
When thoughts turn into reality.
Like, can you be a Republican and Democrat at the same time?
Well, aren't they the same?
If you take the time element, you'd say they're part of a larger cycle. You know, if you look at it through time.
That's true.
You know.
And then we get into the kind of time description that our friend Bonnie DeVarco likes to talk about, which is the sequential time and the non-sequential time, the Kairos and the Chronos. So.
Yes, well, we'll save that for Bonnie, because that's deep. And this, we're trying to do the news here.
Oh, yes, right. News. That's definitely Chronos
time.
You know,
film
sequential.
There is, no doubt about it.
It's a little premature.
However, we'll get into that. There is really hard news. The U.S. has sent radiation-hardened robots to Japan.
That's right, Dr. Future. We talked about this last week, about the robots that we sent. They were like, what, $170,000 each. They were big, able to move large. But the problem is they're radio-controlled. And if you're in a radioactive place, there's too much noise that the radio waves can't get to the little robots.
Right, yeah, they get cut off from communication. Right, exactly.
So, binga, banga, boom, our U.S. government, boy, either they had one in their back pocket or they made one really fast.
Well, apparently about a week ago, iRobot, it's a company out of Massachusetts, shipped four of these remote control robots that apparently are radiation hardened and communication improved.
And they're also the same manufacturer that sent the robots last week.
That's right, yeah. They learned.
And then, they learned and they changed.
Exactly, yeah.
Very smart.
I think so. They say the robots can be used for search and rescue and also for the damaged nuclear facilities. But it looks like they could use them in both places. And they're equipped with multiple cameras and they can be operated from half a mile away. Really excellent for operators at the nuclear power plant. People can stay that safe distance and still get the job done.
So, Dr. Future, I have just put that up on our Cinecast for our dear audience.
Thank you,
if you are near a computer
and
you would like to watch along with the articles that we're talking about, you can go to ksco.com/
Dr. Future.
No, Dr. Future.
Yeah,
I guess I'm there right now. I'm not seeing it.
Well, you get hopefully to post, so you have a different link here.
Oh, it's up now. It is.
There
okay. So just go to ksco.com/Dr. Future and you'll get to see all the different articles that we're going to talk about today. And also you could go to the drfutureshow.com and at the links page you can follow along because Dr. Future has put up all the links.
That's
that
what
he
I use.
Is going to be talking
I got
about.
My links up right in front of me and as I look at what to do next, I go there.
And they're really great links, Dr. Future. When you sent me the email today for us to prepare for our show today, I just, once again.
Did you have a favorite one?
I had several favorite ones, actually, and I look forward to talking about those.
Okay. And I'd just like to chime in that since we're so multidimensional here, we also leave a trail of breadcrumbs on our Twitter feed.
That's right.
Our Dr. Future Show Twitter feed where we do little synopses of the conversation that is flying by as we discuss these links.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of also if you go to the Dr. Future Show, ksco.com, Dr. Future Show, you also have a chat room there.
Yes.
So you can talk with other people listening as we talk.
You will find that the Sinocast is a little bit from the future. No other radio stations are using this yet. Probably very few of you out there will even attempt to use it just yet because you're used to just listening to radio. But a few of you, the early adopters, will try it out, and you will see that this is the future of radio, at least from our perspective.
So if you went there right now to ksco.com/Dr. Future, you would be able to see the Computer World article that we're talking about right now about the U.S. sending these radiation-hardened robots to Japan, these remote-controlled robots that will be used at the damaged Fukushima Daiichi facility.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, what's next, Dr. Future?
Two birthdays in the geek world.
Happy birthday, somebody.
One is a person, Dean Kamen.
Dean Kamen, I love him. Inventor of the Segway.
That's what he's most famous for.
But he's also a medical devices, kidney dialysis. I love this guy.
Born April 5th, 1951.
Happy birthday, Dean. We love you.
He also has worked extensively in a project involving Stirling engine designs. He's attempting to create machines that would generate power from steam.
Oh.
And
the sun.
I believe I read quite some time ago that Google was putting in a number of these Stirling engines to create power at their Menlo Park plant.
He is definitely one of our modern-day Thomas Edisons in terms of the things that he's been thinking about.
Yes, he is.
You know, so happy birthday, Dean.
Happy birthday, Dean Kamen.
And the other birthday today is the 30th anniversary of the first portable PC. You know how we all use laptops today? You know how common laptops are? I mean, we prefer them over desktops and all that good stuff. Well, the first one was only 30 years ago today.
Happy birthday, portable PC.
Actually, April 1st. It was designed by a guy named Adam Osborne, the Osborne 1 computer. I remember when that came out. It was a big deal.
How big was it?
It was kind of like a sewing machine case. It was really quite something. But it was portable. And you could carry, and you had this little tiny 5-inch screen and two floppy drives. And if you paid extra, you'd have a hard drive on board.
Wow.
It was cool to be able to just lug this thing. It was the beginning of the luggable world.
In 1981?
April 1st.
Dang, Dr. Future.
And Adam Osborne was so proud of it. He's very British. He said, yes, this is my invention. This will change the world. And he was right. He went on to make other inventions like the 3D spreadsheet that never really took off, but this was something that he was successful with.
Hey, Dr. Future, do you happen to have one at the DigiBarn?
We sure do.
You do?
We have at least one or two.
How would somebody get to go and see this at the DigiBarn?
Well, for those who don't know, the DigiBarn is a computer history museum, but done as a hobby. We have about 500 machines that go back to 1975, all the way to the 90s when things started to get rare. So digibarn.com, check it out, and you can see our little funky DigiBarn museum.
Right, with three pigs?
D-I-G-I-B-A-R-N. Yeah, 500 computers and three pigs. And
three
a lot of the computers work, and all the pigs are alive.
Right on. Well, stay tuned, everybody, for more Dr. Future here at KSCO.
Yeah. Thanks for listening.
1080. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. So the 30th anniversary of the first portable computer, the beginnings of the laptop, is today. Adam Osborne. That's an amazing invention, and I think we all are benefiting from that.
Only so, 30 years old. Does that mean we should never trust any laptop over 30?
You should try using that 30-year-old laptop. First of all, it was before Windows. I think it was CPM was the first one. Not even MS-DOS.
We were talking about distance in space years, time in computer years. I mean, 30 years old has got to be the Stone Age for computers.
Oh, yeah. It was the early days, the Precambrian era, I like to call it. I call it the Precambrian era because there were literally hundreds of new machines coming out then of all different sizes and varieties. That compares to a time in species evolution when nature was doing the same thing with life forms, putting eyeballs on the end of stalks by the dozens, mouths at the tail as well as the front end, a lot of very weird experiments. And
so
that
let's
was like
see,
that
what did we? What were
like
we
that.
Getting? Texas Instrument calculators? Yeah. What else?
This is 1980, 81. Well, just before that, the Apple came out. The Apple sort of set an open standard for exploration. People designed thousands of plug-in cards for the Apple II that could do amazing things. Turning it into a dual-trace oscilloscope was one I tested with a little help from Gregory McNichol here in Santa Cruz. Computer graphics animation cards were coming out. People were using them for whatever they do, car diagnostics. You name it. It was truly Promethean because the technology could be applied to anything that you do. Anything. Even writing was transformed by the word processor, went away from the typewriter. And I don't know how many writers even think about typewriters today.
Seems to me I was in school and I was just learning to use a Wang computer.
Wang was
a little microcomputer that university had. Yeah.
Aw. I remember my sister had the punch cards in the 70s. And she had the first TI calculator on campus at Purdue University. I think it was 1974, 75.
Huh?
And it was big. It was bigger than my iPad, actually, and heavier.
Yeah, the TI was in the running there for a while. They came out with the TI-99.
Well, when my sister started school, she was using the slide rule.
Yeah.
And then she got the calculator. It was a big deal. Everybody wanted to see it.
Yeah, the TI calculator.
The TI awesome. Calculator. And then she had the punch cards. She had to go in the middle of the night and go do that. And one of those cards was in the wrong order. It was all over.
Did she get into the HP at all? Because HP was kind of like the Mercedes-Benz of calculators back then.
No, I think she kind of put it aside.
Yeah.
She was a TI person. And then, of course, by the time I rolled around in the 80s, all my work was on computers.
Did you learn reverse Polish notation?
I was a huge Polish notation lover.
Really?
Yes.
In case you folks wonder about that, it was a way in which the HP calculators put in information. Like, you know how we add, like, 3 plus 3 equals 6?
With the Polish, you would say 3, 3, then you would give the function. So it would be plus, or time is.
That's right, Agent.
Or divide.
Yeah. And 3 enter, 3 enter plus, something like that?
It was so much easier for me. It was incredible. It was a big deal when I had to turn to the regular. That kind of died away,
put
didn't
the
it?
The function at the end. And was that because that how a Polish language works? Or I'm wondering.
I don't know.
I
don't think so.
Many languages put
Slavic
the verbs
language.
At the end.
No, they don't do that.
Interesting.
They do noun, verb.
Well, I can tell you my memory of that time is I was a typesetter. I was a prepress person, and they had just created the ability for typesetting to be sent in through the telephone. And you had to use a FIDO board, which was the old BBS upload, like the Santa Cruz Internet Music Underground had a FIDO board. And you would use a modem and call the FIDO board
and then send a file to
upload and then hang up. And then somebody else would call in and get the file.
You know what was really hot about the FIDO board?
What?
It was self-replicating.
Oh, viral.
It contained within it
fractal.
The code for replicating itself. So you could go onto a FIDO board and you could download its source code and then install one on your server.
Ooh.
So it allowed itself to spread.
Hey, I'll tell you, I was looking for a FIDO board when I saw AOL at an early Mac World, and it was just one of those little cheapo booths, people selling upload FIDO boards.
So KSCO, do you have any memories of back in the day, your first time with your PC?
Your
or
geek
maybe
moments.
Your first geek moments.
You can tell us.
Please give us a call here at 479-1080. All right, so what's up? What's next?
Okay, well, one of the interesting things is that there was an article in, Salon, Salon online. They did a poll of how much money people thought was going to public broadcasting. The general public thinks 5% of the federal budget goes to NPR and PBS.
Oh, boy. Only our federal budget was that small.
And so Salon did this great article like, if PBS really did get 5%, it would be about $178 billion.
Wow. That's probably more than most of the countries in the world.
And they said that if NPR had that kind of movie, they were wondering what it would do with that kind of money, like giving their liberal bias and their support of Sharia law and stuff like that that NPR is accused of. Salon had some guesses, like, wait, don't tell me, would be broadcast live from a moon base. Or that PBS.
Not on the space station. It's scary up there.
Yeah. Or that PBS would require a donation of at least $100 million before sending you a DVD box set of Fleetwood Mac reunions.
Only big players need apply.
Or Frontline would always be an IMAX 3D.
Wow. Frontline.
Yeah, or Robert Siegel, Neil Conan, voiced at all times by Kiefer Sutherland and Morgan Freeman.
Well, so how much does NPR get, really?
Click and clack would be androids. That's a good question. I can see why the public is confused, because it's not like a number that's on the tip of many minds.
Well, they do say that the BBC, which is the largest broadcasting
budget
in the
Western world,
has a $7 billion budget.
So a fraction of the fraction that we were looking at.
$7.5 billion.
And I've heard like $3 or $4 billion or something like that.
If that.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Terry Gross would conclude interviews by deciding if the subject lives or dies. I like this one. Ken Burns documentaries would be produced with original footage obtained via time travel.
Nice.
I like this one. Children's Television Workshop would purchase the entirety of Brooklyn Bedford neighborhood in order to film Sesame Street.
Garrison Keillor could finally get that thing with his sinuses cleared up. Anyway, you get the
that
idea.
That will be the day.
Yeah, $178 billion. Amazing what you can do with that kind of money.
If you could fix Garrison Keillor's voice, that would be fabulous.
Yeah.
Because I love him. He's just puts me to sleep every time I listen to him.
He relaxes me.
I love Garrison Keillor.
He brings a smile
to
my mind.
I do, too. He's hilarious. It's just, I'm saying.
A simpler time.
So moving on with the news, there is a new augmented reality app for your iPhone that will unleash your inner artist.
What does augmented reality app mean? Please deconstruct this for me, Dr. Future.
Well, augmented reality is the idea that your intelligent phone, your smartphone, can tune into what's around you in real time and give you information about it in one way or another. Like, you want to know where the closest restaurant is probably the first primitive implementation of augmented reality. Another one that I saw recently was a Spanish to English sign translator, where you hold up your camera in your iPhone or Android to a to a sign, and it'll translate it from Spanish into English.
Fabulous.
So it's sort of the idea that your computer has sensors, and it can pick up on your environment and then use its computer brain to tell you something about it.
Yeah, to give you a little bit more info about where you're at and what's going on around you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Dr. Future, we've got a phone call here from Tom in Salinas, and he's going to share with us his first computer moments.
All right.
Hey, thanks for calling, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Very embarrassing, but a long time ago, 100 years ago, I was talking to this girl, and I thought she knew me, and I liked her and everything, and she, you know, gave me some information, and came back, you got mail. So I went out to the mailbox to look for a letter. That I never got.
Oh, man. Now talk about augmented reality. You know the story?
You were a got mail kind of guy, huh?
That's funny.
Yeah, as sad as it could be, you know. I'm looking out there in the mailbox for a letter that never came.
Oh, and it was really in your email box?
Yes, but I didn't know what email meant.
Oh, destiny.
I was having a blonde moment.
Was this an unrequited love story?
I don't know. It doesn't matter.
I guess she unfriended you after that.
That was before
first
Facebook.
Peak moment.
Yeah,
have
beautiful.
A good day.
No, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. So
that's a new story.
Yeah, that's a twist.
The love romance that could have happened that didn't happen because of misunderstanding of computer jargon.
Oh,
he had only clicked on the inbox.
He didn't write me back.
And she just went off and found another man and probably got married.
Yeah, well, you know, if she sent him an email, there's no telling how many emails she sent.
Yeah, and it
until someone finally replied.
That's right. She needed someone who was at her speed, who had her URL, her email address.
Yeah. Well, just think, if he had met her, he probably wouldn't have called us, and we wouldn't have this great story to share with you.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
All right, so
back to the AR.
Augmented reality, in case our dear audience didn't know what AR stood for.
Yes.
Our future.
Yeah, Tom had a case of augmented reality there with the email thing.
Yeah, combining, it kind of mixes the real world, what we call meet space, with the cyber world. Meet space meets cyber world. And the boundaries between the two are becoming less clear.
So you can do these things where you hold up the smartphone to a sign and it'll translate it. Another one that they're talking about is a graffiti app where it allows you to tag your place a la virtual Banksy style in a forthcoming app called Scrawl.
Really? Scrawl? Huh?
And so you don't have to really get the spray paint. You can just pretend it's
there. Oh, I've heard about
that.
Yeah, that looks cool. You can be a bad boy and you can easily erase it later so people don't get upset about it as much.
Well, I was always amazed, like, going to really old places, like, such as Florence, you know, and seeing all the graffiti all over. Like, Michelangelo's David had...
There was graffiti on Michelangelo's David?
They had given him black toenail polish.
And for real or in the virtual version?
For real. This was back in the 80s.
It gives me an idea, Agent Nada.
Oh, yeah? What's that, Dr. Future?
That we can have incredible pieces of art that you can mess with.
That's right.
And you can spray paint and get away with it. And other people can see your handiwork, and if it's popular, you'll get kudos.
Oh, in fact, you could do a whole social media game where you do all kinds of virtual spray paint and then have people rate it with thumbs up or thumbs down. And then once a month, you could, like, paint the real thing.
Ooh, there you go. And actually almost get caught by the police or have to run away.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
I'd like to see that in virtual worlds. I think that'd be interesting. Yeah, some place where you can really have fun with famous art. Because it would inspire you. You'd see the credibility of that art and add your incredibility to it.
There's another project here that they're talking about where it removes annoying corporate logos.
Ooh, that sounds valuable.
So just block it out. I don't even want to see that thing.
So much for branding. You know how much energy goes into branding products?
Opposite of minority.
You have any idea how mainstream that is?
I
Everybody's
like
thinking
it.
About that, all the way down to the mom and pop stores about branding their name.
Right.
And you're saying this gets rid of that.
And here's the app that will get rid of it for you.
How much is it?
It's free.
It's free.
No, they're still making it. Hopefully it'll be free.
You have to pay for it to get rid of all those other brands. You have to give this brand your money.
I like it. I think it's really interesting. In fact, it's one of the MFA graduates of this year's Digital Arts and New Media program.
Yeah.
Also does an augmented reality piece as his MFA graduate project.
Really?
Yes.
Does he tell you what it is?
I'm going to find out tonight on Artist on Art.
Yeah, let's see. Anybody out there doing a augmented reality software, we'd like to know.
Tell us about it, please.
Also, just because Artists on Art may be something our KSCO audience would like to tune into now that they know there's an augmented reality report happening. Artists on Art is available live.
At 88.1, it's the UCSC KZSC radio station. If you happen to be on the FM dial, of course, we want you to stay on the AM side of things.
That's true. You don't want to miss 1080, but an Artists on Art show is always posted on your Artists on Art
.net. That's right. So we have another phone call, Dr. Future, Mrs. Future. This is Michael from Watsonville. He wants to share with us also his first computer. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, Michael.
Am I on the air?
You're
yes,
on the
you
air.
Are.
Welcome
you know,
to the Dr. Future
we
show.
Are not augmented here, Michael. We are live human beings pushing buttons.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I thought I'd just mention my first computer experience. I remember it clearly.
Yeah?
My father brought home a Commodore 64.
Ah, I remember those.
My brother, who was always more tech savvy than me, even at a very young age, was very excited. But I was a science fiction fan as a child, and still am. And as all science fiction fans know, computers can randomly explode if they're not treated right. So while my brother was in the room turning this thing on and playing around with it, I was hiding. That's my first computer experience.
You were afraid of the explosion. Oh,
I was afraid of the potential explosion.
I'm so glad you survived.
Yes, me too. I loved that Commodore 64. It was the best toy ever.
Would you mind telling us what year that was, Michael, without having to too much date yourself?
Oh, gosh. Well, I was probably around 8 at the time, so that would make it 86.
Wow. 86.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for sharing, Michael.
Yeah, I remember the Commodore.
Fear brought to the young one.
By the way, the Commodore 64 was one of the first machines used for making those robot calls to people. You know, you ever get those messages from...
The voice?
Yeah, with the voice.
With the scary
Commodore 64
voice.
Had that all set up on it. It was one of the first business machines that did that.
Do you have a Commodore 64 at the Digibar?
No, but I had a girlfriend at the time that I went, oh, yeah, at the Digibar. Yeah, we have one. Yeah, we do have
one. You didn't have a Commodore 64, but you had a girlfriend? What was
she
that?
She had one. She had one.
Yeah. So did you date her for the Commodore?
No. I wasn't that into the Commodore.
But it was a nice stuff.
I appreciated it, yeah.
What would you call it?
It was better than her Victor 9000, which was sad compared to the Commodore. I think the Commodore was a nice machine.
A French benefit.
A French benefit?
A fringe,
yes. Yes, it was. I had a word processor. I was able to write my adventures at the time. Very grateful for that. The other thing about augmented reality that I thought was worth mentioning was that there was an April Fool's joke that Google put out just a few days ago that was all about a gesture language for doing your email.
And I fell for it.
Did you believe it?
Google got me again. They got me last year in front of the kids, which was the worst. Because they laughed about it for a year. And I believe I was with you when I got it again, the April Fool. Google got me yet again.
What really impressed you? What was the, you mean like moving your hands?
Yes. So for our dear audience, for them to know what it was a new Google app had been announced by Google. And this was an app that allowed you to gesturally, so you make gestures at your computer, and the computer would then send a new email, get your email, go to a different URL. It had all kinds of like kind of gestural, kind of like when you're flying a plane, like you're directing a plane to land. It was kind of like that. That's what it reminded me of. It even had a flag in one of them.
You do this little dance and it opens up a new email. Do this little dance and it sends it.
What was the one that you hit
Google
your,
gesture language?
You slap your knee.
You had to slap your knee. That was one of them. And they had it going.
Yeah, slap your knee to delete.
Yeah, and so here, Agent Nod is in there. Yeah, I can see that. She's a big Zumba fan.
Great, sign me up. Let's go get it.
We should have a dancing interface for our email, eh? It only makes sense. And the voice input.
It would help the obesity problem around the world.
Right.
They had all these like little, you know, tidbits on the side of what this new app was going to do for the world. Boy, they had me up until one of the gestures, maybe it was the flag one, where I started to get a little like, this doesn't seem right. Did I get Googled again? And I did. Damn you, Google!
Well, the joke's on Google.
The joke's on Google.
Because it turns out that hackers turned the Gmail April Fool's joke into a reality.
Ha-ha!
Yeah, because, you know, it didn't seem like it was that far off, really.
No. Take that, Google.
And it wasn't. And someone used one of our favorite little gadgets, the Kinect box. That goes with the 360.
I bet a Wii would do, too. You get a couple Wii handles.
Probably so.
Yeah.
But the Kinect is the cool thing because you don't need to have any gadget. Nothing.
Well, what's up in our last little segment here of our first hour?
We're talking about old computers. We're going to go way back. We're going to go back.
Way back.
Way back.
To the beginning.
To the very first computer ever.
That we have found.
Probably older than you think.
Can you say it for us?
Antikythera.
Antikythera.
Give
us a call. KSCO.
I hear something.
You're on, Dr.
I hear something out there. Music.
The radio waves.
Ah, very good. Very good. Okay, as I was mentioning, we're going to go look at the oldest computer ever to be unearthed by our species. It's an ancient Greek computer. It's called the Antikythera device.
And Antikythera is about the island.
That's right.
Off the coast. It's a Greek island that they found this. This is out of Wired Science magazine. Mm-hmm.
The Antikythera was found on an old ship at the bottom of the ocean. It was removed by the first team to use underwater diving equipment that involved helmets and air and that sort of thing. And it was a real boon for discovering the Mediterranean back then, because there were so many ships that had sunk in the Mediterranean.
And this is in 1901.
Yeah, 1901. And they didn't know how long to stay under, and a lot of the divers died of bends and
Because they didn't know, right.
It was a new science or a new adventure.
New experience, for sure.
Right. Suddenly, you know, these early guys were, well, some of them were archaeologists. They were deeply into the, you know, what they were finding as ancient artifacts. And there were a lot of, let's face it, there were a lot of pirates and plunderers, too. And it wasn't long before they as well had all the gear, and they were looking for stuff and looting all these ships and making personal fortunes. It was an interesting time. In this case, they had found a gadget that didn't look like much. They didn't know what it was, and it sat for many years untouched in a museum in Athens until some people, I think within the 30s, started to notice that there were gears inside this strange-looking glob of rock, and they took it apart, and it turned out to be a very complex mechanism, a 2,000-year-old assemblage of gears and wheels.
Intricate gear systems. That we have slowly been learning about.
37 interlocking dials.
And this calculator was an astronomical...
From what we've been able to figure, it was an early astronomical calculator doing things like astrolabes did and navigational things and tracking long cycles, too. Cycles that were considerably longer, like 18, 20-year cycles, and I think there were...
Well, they did the four-year cycle for the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
It kept track of the day of the year and the positions of the sun and the moon and perhaps the other planets.
Mm-hmm. Just to give you an idea of the complexity, it wasn't until the 19th century that we had anything as sophisticated in terms of gears as the early Swiss watches exhibited. So this was 2,000 years ahead of its time, and no one still knows where it came from, and there really haven't been other devices comparable to that in the time. So it's really anomalous.
So what's the newest news, Dr. Future?
It looked like they were aware of the sun moving slower at some times of the year and faster at others, even though the gears turned at a constant speed.
So it tracked the sun?
Yeah, it tracked the sun very accurately in terms of its speed. It was able to predict subtle weirdnesses in the motion of the moon as well, because the moon's orbit around the Earth is an ellipse. Now, early people didn't think about ellipses that much, or at least we didn't think they did, but it looks like the Antikythera device may have predicted ellipsoid type movements by early civilization, which showed that they knew more about the circular solar system than was tended to be believed.
It's incredible. And they've dated it at about, what, 100 BC, 100 AD?
Second century BC.
Second century BC. 200 yeah. BC.
Yeah.
It's just phenomenal. Those ancient Greeks, boy, they were just...
Yeah.
Running around, getting all that information from anybody who'd give it to them, I guess.
They had wheels predicting Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, all that thing.
And just think, all of that was probably in the Great Library of Alexandria that got burned. I bet there was like a user's manual.
You're
to
probably
go with
right.
the Antikythera device.
Maybe the name of the inventor even, huh? It's an early incarnation of Dean Kamen.
All that got burned up. Oh, it's tragic.
Well, fortunately, there are surviving pieces of this original mechanism. And with modern-day technology, we've been able to really begin to understand its secrets.
So we're slowly getting the user manual.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to share that with the audience today.
And for our last article of sharing...
Oh, yes. As you folks may or may not know, we now have two iPads in the Dr. Future family here. Agent Nada has one.
iPad 2s.
iPad 2s.
You have an iPad also,
right.
So there's really three.
Dr. Future has an iPad 1.
Dr. Future.
But he still loves it. However, the iPad 2s are in the hands of my trusty agents here. And there's a story there that I think I should turn over to you, Agent Nana.
Well, this is a story that I've heard about before, and it is the concept that you could do an entire record album on GarageBand. And not only that, but you could do it on your iPad. And so this article, which was published here in Wired magazine, talks about specific artists who did just that. They recorded an album entirely on their iPad 2 using GarageBand.
GarageBand, no, for the uninitiated, what's GarageBand?
GarageBand is a really great program. It's a computer program for the computer, but it's also a application for your iPhone, or I don't know if it's for the iPhone, but I know it's on your iPad.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows for the mixing of vocals, and it comes loaded with all different kinds of sounds, such as guitar sounds, bass guitar sounds, drums, drum beats. You can manipulate a lot. There are more sophisticated music making programs.
But the user interface is pretty easy, so people can learn.
But GarageBand is easy peasy. And this is just incredible. In fact, I went ahead. You know, Dr. Future, my chintzy is. So what do you want to say about that? I don't like to pay for my apps, basically, for my iPhone or my iPad.
This is an expensive one, Agent Nana.
I think it was $4.99.
That's right.
But I had to do it because I want to also be able to play with my iPad this way. I'm not a musician, but I know what I like to hear, and it's incredible. I mean, my kids, they would make music, and in 5 minutes, they'd do a song.
Hmm.
And they would take a clip of me saying something mommy-like, you know, wash your hands. And then they'd make a whole movie about it, or a whole song about it.
So you could create some soundtracks for your videos, too, then, eh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's fully loaded with violins. Just about every instrument you can think of is sampled in the GarageBand.
That's a great idea.
Program and app.
Yeah, I think we'll bring some on for next week's Dr. Future. We'll start using more sound effects in the show.
I think that would be fabulous.
Okay, so what happened here? There was a group that utilized the iPad 2 to create, their entire album?
Their entire album was made. So basically, for $500, just to buy the iPad, they were able to both create and record music. In fact, their entire record.
The Ultra Mods. And the name of their album, Underwear Party.
Underwear Party. And they're selling their album for $10. If you go to Wired, you can get to have a free MP3 track.
That's amazing. Wow. So any of you folks out there could do this if you have so inclined. You can create your own album with GarageBand and get a couple of vocalists that you love and have at it.
Well, what's the beauty of it is that this GarageBand app was made specifically for touchscreen interface. So you're really touching the screen with this application. And they're really moving, I feel, with the new apps that I've been able to look at with the iPad 2, towards tools for creativity and not just for consumption, but actually you're creating. And we've talked about this before. The big reason why I was gifted the iPad 2 is so my sister wanted me to make more media, and I started cutting iMovies because iMovie is also another application that has been made for the iPad 2.
Yes, and speaking of that, Mrs. Future has posted a movie yesterday.
I joined Agent Nada in the ranks of people who have published their first iPad movies. I just published a local movie on this last weekend's Trash and Fashion show.
And that was high school kids making fashion out of trash in Santa Cruz?
Yes, sponsored by the Environmental Cleanup Coalition.
Awesome.
That has the gyrecleanup.org website, gyrecleanup.org. And they put on this amazing kid and adult, but I mostly focused on the kid for our YouTube fashion show, where they had the most amazing fashions I've ever seen, not just because they were made of trash, but they were really amazing fashions. So if you go to YouTube/MuseCineMedia, which is our media company, Muse, MuseCineMedia, you will see the Trash and Fashion Show.
Let's put it up on our website, too.
Okay. Yeah. And what's up in the next hour, Dr. Future?
Oh, you're going to meet an amazing person.
Oh, yeah? What's his name?
Charles Osman, historian of the future.
And I'm going to have that up on the Sinocast so people can see his website.
Yes. Yes, Charles is quite the prognosticator. And he'll get you thinking about some very important things. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. This hour we have guest Charles Osmond, a historian of the future, he calls himself. I'd like to think of him as a strategic thinker. He's the kind of guy the Pentagon would hire for coming up with scenarios, different scenarios. What if Libya decided to use a nuke, Charles would tell you. Or what happens if China wanted to move to California or buy up California? Charles will help you with this.
That's pretty close.
Charles himself. Hey, Charles, welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
The virtual MD becomes organic. Yes, indeed. I think your description was fairly apt. I've worked for a bunch of different think tanks, and sometimes we do have DARPA finance projects and or, you know, sort of connections to the Pentagon with these kinds of ideas.
Well, you're a very creative thinker. That's what I like about you.
Well, thank you so much. I've been accused of much worse, so I'm glad to hear your positive way of looking at it.
You give us all permission to think out of the box.
Thank you so much. I'll have to remember that for future reference. Out of the box enabler.
Please. So what's on your mind now?
Well, actually, I just was on the air on Sunday doing a three-way conversation with Dr. Nick Baggage and Michael Vail, and it was really interesting because we were talking about things like neurological sovereignty, which sounds a little bizarre, but I can explain what that means. Mm-hmm. But this whole idea of your thoughts of your own, that what you think and what you possess in the realms of your own personal sovereignty, you should stay that way, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Rather than being influenced by media or more directly by some kind of mental probes?
Mental probes and or technology designed to disrupt that. So, and this sounds a little bit futuristic, but in fact the technology is being deployed and tested as we speak, and that's kind of why we had the conversation.
Do you believe that HAARP has any of this kind of mind control capability?
And no. Let me clarify. Because, first of all, there's much more than just one HAARP.
Okay, well, let's define HAARP for the audience.
Yeah, please. I mean, essentially, it's a gigantic antenna system. Mm-hmm. That can project, in this case, millions of watts mm-hmm. of collimated RF frequency as a carrier, and then it can also project any variety of frequencies, from ultra-low frequency to extremely high frequency, whatever you want to project, mm-hmm. as a collimated beam. And the original purpose was to bounce a beam of energy off the ionosphere, really for over-the-horizon radar. This was long before satellites were used as they are now. This goes back to the late 50s, actually.
So for long-distance radar
correct.
Detection.
Correct, what's called over-the-horizon radar. Uh-huh. And then later, as the idea of these sort of collimated radio beam concepts became much more refined and people began to explore other ideas, one of the things that really kind of put a lot of effort and funding into this were the SALT II trees. Mm-hmm. And the reason was because, if you remember the strategic earnings limitation talks, mm-hmm. if you want to think of it this way, in the old days, back when the Soviet Union and us were the two major contenders in the world,
sure.
the idea was we have what's called a nuclear triad. And we had the missiles in the silos, we had the bombers in the air, mm-hmm. and we had the submarines. The unfortunate problem was you had direct chain of command control over your bombers in the air and the missiles in the silo. But because of the lack of communication potential at the time, the sea captains, the commanders of the submarines, mm-hmm. if under certain circumstances, could autonomously begin to launch. Mm-hmm. And we both recognized.
It's like the fail-safe movie was
kind of exactly right. And I mean, we've seen a bunch of those. But yes, there was a reality to that. So mm-hmm. the thought was, if we're going to enter in any kind of treaty where we can have some kind of verifiable, you know, trust but verify kind of aspect to this, mm-hmm. the missing link would be, how do you communicate with the submarines with the same kind of command control structure that can be verified as we had with their air and missile resources? So it was out of that, really, the major beginning funding process started. Mm-hmm. Without going into a lot of details, the whole point was, yes, you can bounce these beams of radio information off of the ionosphere down to a known area in a very precise way, and then if the submarine in question is there, it'll lodge an antenna that it tows behind and can pick up their message and so on. Okay, fine.
I see. So you're saying that they found many other purposes for it besides long-distance communication?
Right. And so what happened was, as a consequence of getting ever more powerful and ever more precisely tuned beams that could be kept in a really tight pattern over very long distances, mm-hmm. what they found was this would warm up the ionosphere. It would actually change the chemistry and the electrodynamics and just it would cause all these different changes that you could see and measure.
And considerably more than radio waves were doing all
that? Yes, because this is a bad comparison in a way, but a laser is coherent light, where all the photons are sort of packed together in a very phase linear fashion. Mm-hmm. So this is not a maser. A maser is the same thing with radio waves. But it's something like a maser. It's a very tightly packed, focused beam of radio energy. A lot of energy into a small amount of area over a length of time. It will change the electrodynamics and thermodynamics of whatever you're targeting, especially if the absorption spectra of the material, you know, is responding to the radio waves. So mm-hmm. in this context, they found that, gee, we can create a hotspot.
Yeah, like beaming a hole in the ionosphere.
Either a hole or just change the temperature. Huh. Now, that's interesting because if you want to play around with things like changing the jet stream, or other things, which gets a little more complicated. I mean, a variety of folks, for very interesting reasons, said,
maybe this could be useful. You know, weather modification was one of them. In fact, the Soviet Union had this interesting idea. They thought that they could move the jet stream around so they could, in a sense, create regions of Siberia, which could then be transferred into farmable land, and they could raise crops and change their economy and so on.
Yeah.
But it became obvious that the cost of energy to drive these things would be fantastic and just not worth the effort.
Yeah.
However, along the way, it was also discovered that a bunch of other things could be done with this. So there's patents been filed. There have been human treaties that have been signed going back to 97, 96. I can't remember which year. But
so lots of uses were discovered for the HAARP. Some of them were developed. Some of them were impractical because of energy and
energy consumption at that time. And that's where I wanted to perhaps tune into the more modern world.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you remember, former Secretary of Defense Cohen actually said, he said in a very famous speech in 97, which was just after the treaty was signed, now that I recall, he said, look, watch out. This is going to happen. There are people out there who will specifically want to cause weather change. They'll want to invoke tectonic events. They'll want to invoke mental disturbances on a mass scale. You know, he lists all these different things.
Now, 97, wasn't that the time when Nick Begich wrote Angels Don't Play the
Harp? Yes, indeed so. In fact, I was in this conversation just a couple of days ago, and that was the whole point, was that this was, even at that time, seemed to be a serious enough issue where people had to say, look, forget the science fiction stuff. This is the real deal. We need to have policies. We need to have some way of having verifiable standards and, you know, some kind of international board that can recognize what these things are, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Well, things have moved along much since that point, you can imagine.
Oh, hold on, please. Mr. Charles Osman, second. Was this when you were here at KSCO?
I was at KSCO, gosh, this was, I think, like in 95 or 96. This was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I was talking about nanotechnology and specialized materials at the time, which was my background, actually. I mean, so that's what we were talking about.
Yeah.
But it was at 8 or 9 o'clock at night. I was staying with Bruce Damer, who actually had a cabin out there. Now, he's moved to a spaceship farm. But this was, like, ancient history. I don't remember ever talking about HAARP at the time. I just remember talking about specialized materials and nanotechnology as a pathway to enabling all these different types of developments. This being one of them, by the way, as a segue, because now, of course, if you run the numbers and you do some engineering, the whole idea is, can you get more bang for the buck in terms of how much more efficient can you aim the energy, how much more efficient can you compact a power supply, how much more precisely can you pack other kinds of information into the radio beam that you're aiming at, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
And the answer is yes to all the above. And so what you have now are portable versions that are truck-mounted, designed really to cause, let's just say, mental disturbance and extreme discomfort to a targeted group of people, you know, across the battle line or in a town, that kind of thing, up to and including large arrays, which can be used to create a momentary disturbance of some kind.
So you're talking about potential military applications.
Oh, more than potential. It's actually a defined asset, a strategic asset.
Hence, you have the neurological sovereign
need. Yes, that was part of it. The other thing is, there's something called the NBIC conference. This was actually a government-sponsored conference. This is the Nanotech, Infotech, Biotech, Cognitech Convergence Conference. It sounds kind of wild, but actually this is an NIH-sponsored event, and it has really the very top end of the scientific community from all these different sciences mixed together with the policymaker types who try to figure out how these things, when they all fit together, creates kind of a mosaic of potential applications, what sort of policy, liability, political consequences, economic, that kind of thing. So people like me in the think tank world, that's the stuff we look at. So been into a number of these things. And I remember this was back at UCLA, I think in 2003 or 2004, I don't know, it was in front of me. But there was a woman from Berkeley who I thought was really interesting because when she got to the podium, the first thing she talked about is, look, we're on the very edge of being able to decode the human mind, decode the brain. We can kind of tell, for instance, there's a variety of technologies, one of which is, it's already been tested in court, by the way. If you experienced an event, like you saw a car crash, or you committed a crime and you saw the body on the ground or something, whatever, there is a definable signature that can be correlated to that event. They can't read your mind exactly, but they can tell that you had seen the whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
This has already been tried in court. And in fact,
here
in the U.S. and also in India, it's been used as evidence. And this was going back a couple, 3 years. Really, it's more a matter of computing capacity rather than sensitivity of probes. And now if you mix together things like squid systems, superconducting quantum interference devices, combined with much more aggressive Fourier transform information analysis, that kind of thing.
So what's the ultimate goal here? To, like, get the enemies to think of themselves on the other side and become part of your team instead of the enemies?
Well, not exactly. Yeah. The current tools for reading the mind are getting ever more robust as we speak. And so that's one side of the neurological sovereignty. The other side says, can I cause you to do something you normally wouldn't want to do? And that's where it gets a little more broad spectrum. The most simplistic way of saying is that as we speak today, if there was a desire to cause anguish in a crowd, cause panic, you know, like when somebody does too much meth or something, I mean, I don't do drugs myself, but let's just say, you know, I've seen people go through these panic attacks.
Well,
if you wanted to create that kind of...
That kind of reaction. On,
right, mass, exactly.
Like paranoia, always, mass paranoia or something.
Correct,
like that.
Exactly right. And in fact, there's some evidence coming out now that going back as far as Iraq One, when we went into Iraq after they invaded Kuwait and all, if you recall, all these guys came out of their bunkers after a few days, and they were docile and just kind of walking about with their hands up. Well, it turns out that we had been blasting all their bunkers with these certain kinds of radio waves to make them essentially dysfunctional.
Yeah. I think I remember back in the Bush administration when they were trying to get Noriega out of his mansion down in Nicaragua, they were putting some strange waves into his...
They were blasting with weird music, and yes, they were blasting with the same kind of waves. I don't know if it was effective in that case, but that was one of the early attempts.
Uh-huh.
And I can assure you that the technology, like I said, just because of material science, you get much more efficiency, much more complexity in terms of process. Everything kind of improves over a certain
range. So what do you suspect as being the capability today?
Well, if you want to talk about neurological damage, that's one area. The larger picture, as I see it, is that there's what's called acts of God, quote unquote, dot, dot, dot. And this gets into very complex sovereignty issues, admiralty law, international diplomacy treaties based on economic trade agreements. It gets into a very, very complex...
You mean like when you say acts of God, like earth changes?
Like earth changes, like tornado all of a sudden showing up where it shouldn't be, or a hurricane wiping out your shipping facility, or heaven forbid, an earthquake that happens to arrive at the precise moment in time, maybe a giant flood that sort of happens at the right moment in time, that sort of thing.
I see you're talking steerable tornadoes.
Yes, exactly so. And so, I mean, you look back across time, and I don't want to claim I have hard evidence on each one of these cases, but if you look at the surrounding circumstances, it does kind of suggest that something could have been done. And then if you look at the technology available, the answer is, yeah, it could have been done. So it's circumstantial, but it's rather strong in that area.
Uh-huh.
You may recall the horrendous in Pakistan. They had horrific rainstorms, floods on a scale they hadn't seen in over a century, and many people died. This was right at the time when we were trying to take the advantage in Afghanistan, and we were chasing them across the border into Pakistan, and Pakistanis weren't necessarily being cooperative with us. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that's too complex to go into right now.
Sure.
Hey, listen, out of the air, they had the worst rainstorms in 100 years. Well, you know, you kind of have to wonder about that.
Yeah, maybe there's something going on. Listen, Charles, you know, this is an interesting mystery to explore, and we have to take a break in a minute, and we also have a caller who'd like to ask you a question
sure.
about this.
We have several callers.
You're sparking the minds of KSCO here. All right.
So hopefully they'll stand by, and you've been listening to KSCO Santa Cruz with Charles Ostman. And if you want to go to his website, it's...
historianofthefuture.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Our guest is Charles Ostman, historian of the future. And we have a caller.
Yes, we've got Nick in Royal Oaks. Welcome, Nick.
Hi, thank you. The Eastern world has always been beautiful in teleplay. I've seen film newsreels and things in the 60s and how they were still with it. Oh, I think we have to bring that back as if it was today because it hasn't been lost. It's like Mishmin Tuhis is the good day from the Moots in Costa Nova. Teleplay means goes into teleban. Something's been upset into the nerves, and they can't, and it's not happening. And then now, Al-Qaeda, to me, is the sound that is made, and that is distorted and confounded in this United States. It's just combined by a finance system. And,
all right.
In Libya.
Hey, thanks for that.
Well, Libya, they're upset. You know, if we had bombed the Iranian parliament, we would not be looking at war with them.
Yeah.
And
hey, Nick, do you have a question? Do you have a question for Charles Ostman?
Well,
no.
We
okay. Okay. Well, thanks for calling. Have a great day. All right. So we got another question that was sent to us.
Yes.
So
this one just came in. You know anything about the aurora borealis effects going on right now, especially over Japan? Charles, are you there?
Charles.
He's still there.
Am I still there?
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, there is a worry about all this going on right now, and it's a little complicated. You may recall that the sun goes through an 11-year cycle that it kind of peaks and then slows down in terms of sunspots and ejecta and that sort of thing. And the coronal mass ejecta, or CME it's called. Friends of mine actually are astrophysicists, and so they have kind of an inside connection to this world, so I get to see what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And this last 11-year cycle had some very odd characteristics. The sun went quiet for several years.
More so than the usual?
More so than the usual. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'm literally about 3 miles from the Space Science Institute, that's the sign.
Yeah, do you think that human beings caused that?
No, not at all. There's a lot of controversy going on as to exactly what is going on. And that gets into the politics of global warming, and that's very complicated. We could spend 5 hours on that.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to get at is all of the planets, from Pluto inward, are experiencing some kind of strange combination of weather change, magnetosphere change, the chemistry of their atmospheres is going through alterations. I mean, there's something going on. In parallel with that, the sun has also been acting a bit oddly, and now it's coming out of its quiet period with a bang. I mean, it's really suddenly just blasting out X flares, and in fact, a huge one just came out a little while ago. Now, fortunately for us, it was facing away from us, and we didn't get cooked by this thing, but should we have been cooked by this X flare, it would have caused some real damage. It certainly would have fried a lot of satellites, could have caused a lot of damage here on Earth, a lot of mutational potential comes out of that, probably would have crashed some power grids. I mean, this is not small stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really understand precisely the long-term sort of macro cycles and macro cycles of stellar life, if you want to call it that. In other words, we can see in small clumps of time, 10, 20, 30 years, look for patterns there. But trying to pick out a 20 or 30-year long collection of patterns out of maybe 4 or 5 billion years, I mean, statistically, that's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, it's hard to know what the actual cycle
is. Exactly right. So,
excuse me, Charles. Wait. We have another caller who wants to talk about the lights over Japan. So
yeah,
this is Alex.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Alex. Welcome.
Yeah, I called earlier because I'm looking online about different stuff in Japan, and I've been interested in HARP for the last few years.
Sure.
And I was hearing about reports of aurora borealis in Japan before the earthquake.
Oh, I see what you're asking. In other words, there's thoughts about HARP having caused the earthquake.
No, exactly. That's where I'm getting at.
Okay, sure.
It's kind of funny. The response from most people is like, oh, you're crazy.
No, but not crazy at all.
Yeah, nowadays there's actually the technology out there to do it.
I know, I've seen it. So here's
there's so much secrecy.
Here's the answer I'd like to give you, and I want to hold this thought very carefully. You're not crazy at all. You're actually quite right. However, was it our HARP or somebody else's? That's where I'm going to ask you to
go. Yeah, exactly.
Because the HARP system in Alaska is an antenna array, and of course they picked up on it. I mean, everybody got it. Actually, ham operators were the first to pick up on this. But where did the actual signal come from, and from what set of circumstances? If I had to pick somebody who was most likely to benefit from this and who would also be most likely to be equipped for it,
China,
and also have the motivation, I think China.
For sure. And I was just talking to an engineer buddy at work about HARP, which is really auspicious you guys are having this show right now, because he was like, oh, it's only to meter and to take readings from the ionosphere, which seems to totally go against what I've heard in the reports that have been declassified. I'm really glad you guys are having this discussion, because it's something that I don't think a lot of people realize, the technology that we have out there and the capabilities to do certain things. And I was wanting you to touch on one more thing, because I think you're a reputable person, is the contrails.
Yeah.
The guys at work made me a helmet out of tinfoil, because I bring it up all the time. And because I think there's a big gap between the realization of the technology and the actual technology.
Well, I don't know enough about this. This is an area that I don't want to claim knowledge of. I've seen some photographs of giant nozzles out of the back of planes, and there's been a bunch of theories offered. Some were saying that it's a way to change the temperature of the Earth, because we know it's already going into a warming phase, and maybe this is some kind of weird...
I've heard radar benefits.
Well, there's another one that says it could be used as a kind of a synthetically enhanced ionosphere, so that we can have even more effective HARP-like situations. You know, that's another answer. Third one is that this is testing of some kind of, like, bio-weaponry/biodefense system that we're sort of evaluating as we over long-term strategy, that kind of thing. I don't really know the answer, but any of those could be possible.
And one more thing, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I remember in the beginning of the Iraq war, there were some organizations like Amnesty International and Doctors Without Borders that were reporting really strange injuries, like laser-created injuries.
Yeah.
And if you could touch on that for just a couple seconds.
Well, actually, the first battlefield lasers ever deployed were from China, and they were intended as blinding lasers.
Can you say that one more time?
Blinding lasers. The theory is that if you were in a tank or in a plane, helicopter, whatever, and you suddenly get the blast of laser light in your eyes, you're going to go blind. And in fact, there's been a number of, and I have to say, a lot of my friends are pilots, so I take a really strong issue with this. There have been some idiots here in this country that think it's fun to take a half-watt laser and shine it up at a jet when it's making final approach. Those guys are going to prison for life, as far as I'm concerned. They're
what about like satellite lasers actually coming in, and you know, carbon dioxide lasers or something that's going to be able to cut through stuff?
Well, I actually worked on a CO2 laser that was called the Antares Project, which is now declassified. You can look it up on the web yourself, but. Just a little side note, how much more time I get here, but...
I was going to say, if it's not declassified, don't say it, because we know what happened to Robert Manning or whatever.
No, but it's
you don't
want to
be naked in a jail cell for 2 months.
It's been declassified for a long time.
Sorry, Charles, we didn't mean to put you in jail.
No, this has been declassified. In fact, it was turned into a scientific platform. But his point is right. The reason that CO2 lasers were handy is because of the larger wavelength of light. They're in the infrared range, which means that the clouds are essentially transparent. And so it's a way to get a beam of something through an otherwise kind of cloudy medium. Now, in more recent times, other techniques are being used, which I won't go into, but one thing I might throw as a sidelight is a whole bunch of folks who are using HARP-like systems to, an extent, cut a hole through a cloud bank or whatever so that something else can come in behind it. Yeah. And I'll just let your thoughts part with that one.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks for calling.
So may I ask a silly question?
Please.
When you say HARP, are you talking about the high-frequency... Active Auroral Research Program.
That's right, exactly.
H-A-A-R-P.
R-P, that's right.
Okay, because there is another HARP, and I wanted to make sure this is the one we're talking
about. Two A's in the HARP.
Not to be confused with Project HARP, the High Altitude Research Project.
Hmm. Well, there's actually a bunch of these all over. The one in Alaska is the H-A-A-R-P. That's the one that's in Alaska that everyone always talks about. Yeah. The reality is there's a bunch of these machines all over the planet. There's more of them being built every day. There is no one single any of these things.
And you're saying they're mobile now.
And they're mobile, exactly. In fact, as I see it, you're going to see these things on ships. You're going to see them in truck convoys. You know, where overnight a couple of trucks come in, they set up a bunch of arrays, and the thing goes online. I mean, that's really where things are at now.
Yeah.
And I think that over time you may even see satellite versions of these if it's not already been done. So again, I think that everybody being so focused on this one HARP array that everybody sees a picture of the internet is a distraction. It's almost like a cover story compared to what's really out there,
gotcha.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
Wow.
Makes sense. Well, and you think China's involved with
you? They are absolutely the people who would do this the most because, A, if you recall, when the Soviet Union was falling apart, you know, just like Project Paperclip at the end of World War II, we had a similar kind of deal when you know, Yeltsin was taking over and the economy was in free fall. There were a whole lot of Soviet scientists that were looking for ways to stay alive, I mean, because there was no economy. And in fact, I personally belonged to something called, or was working with something called the IPP, or Initiative for Proliferation Prevention. And we were trying to harvest, if you will, former Soviet military scientists to give them access to Western venture capital so they could come up with peaceful applications for their scientific knowledge. In fact, I worked with a group called Fourth Venture Group based on Virginia, and we did just that. We went out to a bunch of these trade show or conference-type things, and we helped get some financing for some of these guys, one of which, by the way, is kind of a funny story. There's a beautiful vertical vane wind turbine that was actually developed for Afghanistan. It was a disassemblable, fits into a box kind of thing, unfolds out.
Yeah, I remember when you were promulgating that.
Right, and that's still being developed.
Yeah.
In California, they're working on it now, along with Lawrence Laboratory. Anyway, the guys who developed that, who actually invented and sort of perfected that thing, they were the original rocket scientists. What was the word? Rocket science from the Mauchio State Rocket Facility, which is kind of like the Livermore Lab, if you will, or Los Alamos Lab of Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were developing the Antares system, our whole objective was to create a femtopulse, packets of pulses that we could sort of sprinkle around up in the atmosphere to track and shoot down incoming MIRV warheads, multiple-oriented vehicle warheads. Well, the guys I shook hands with at this trade show in Philadelphia were the guys who designed those MIRVs. So here I was, one of the guys who was working the giant laser, hoping to shoot down their rockets, and here I was, you know, talking to the guys with their rockets. Who, and what was amazing was, I remember this back in 81 or 82 when I was working on this stuff, I thought, you know, we have these fantastic pieces of machinery, the best minds on the planet, building all this stuff. What if we could do something better with it? I very clearly remember thinking that at the time.
Mm-hmm. And I remember that was about the time that Bucky Fuller put out the idea, what about livingry instead of weaponry?
Well, there you go. And so in a weird kind of way, I was able to actually see that very concept come to life.
Imagine if we spend that kind of money on livingry.
Oh, my gosh. The thing that really irks me a lot, the fellow that I called earlier that was kind of ranting and raving, I kind of felt sorry because I could understand his frustration.
Mm-hmm.
Think just for a minute now. We have dozens, if not hundreds, of projects involving different kinds of hydrogen applications, different kinds of fuel cells, using algae as a potential fuel source. I mean, all kinds of different things that are going on. 1 week of our money being thrown away in Afghanistan could pay for all these projects, and even if only 10% of them worked, so what? In other words, this is what makes me so angry.
Yeah, it could rise the tide for us all pretty fast.
Correct. It doesn't take a lot. I used to try, I mean, I don't work in the venture world anymore, but back when I was, a tiny amount of money, I mean, a couple of hours worth of money in Afghanistan would pay for a year's worth of development for these little startups to see if their thing actually works. Mm-hmm. That's what's so crazy about this. And it just, it is angering. So I do understand the frustration.
Well, maybe we can take one of these mobile HAARP units and program it so that people think this way.
Well, we're not quite there yet, but one never knows. But anyway, the thing I wanted to get across again is that all technologies have a plus and a minus to them. It's a yin and a yang, if you want to use that sort of way of looking at it. It's not the tools themselves that are evil, but humans' capacity to use them for
the consciousness that we are.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And so every time I go into one of these public forums, or I give a lot of talks sometimes to various groups and so on, there's always going to be a couple of folks in the audience who start ranting and raving by the caller. And I always say, look, guys, it's not the tools. It doesn't matter. I mean, whether you want to believe them or not, they're there. I mean, so what? You have to figure out the consciousness of the person, not the evil of the machinery. That, to me, is the biggest challenge of all, is to not try to put limits on how you're going to build stuff or create something, because that's going to happen no matter what you do.
Don't you think that the Internet can help raise the intelligence of
I think there's a lot of potential for this. In fact, I think that was the original premise of the program, I think, was to talk about the so-called kill switch for the Internet. And as I was sending in my email to you a couple of days ago, back when I was working on the so-called Y2K project at the time, that was the real essence of it. In other words, yes, there was a legitimate concern that because of the three digit date code, there'd be a lot of failures, and that actually did occur in some cases. But it was taken way past, I think, what the real story was. When I was working on this stuff, the real story was they were looking at, okay, if we put everything online, we sort of put everything into a contiguous real-time sort of control grid system for all of our resources, all of our power grids, all of our chemical plants and refineries and everything else you can possibly imagine, things, systems, all that kind of stuff. It makes it much more easy to run. It's a low-cost, high-efficiency way of solving these problems, but also makes it much more fragile. You know, what's the security implications thereof? And that was the real agenda.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, the Y2K thing was kind of a test run, if you will, or sort of a wake-up call, say, okay, how are we going to harden the system? Where's the line between individuals' rights to using it, whatever they want to, versus the sort of security issue? Now,
well, I think you have broached the topic of looking at the Internet as a biological process.
Yeah, it is. I, at least that's how I see it.
Like a biological part of a species' exonervous system.
I use the terms the Internet as an organism in a bunch of papers I wrote many years ago,
right.
But so other folks have similar ideas, and what they call the Global Brain Society, and I've been a member for years. And, you know,
yeah,
we
and
have
if it's a living thing, that would have right. It would have some kind of immune system that would protect
well,
it.
Well, as a
evolves,
matter of fact, right? Artificial immune systems is one of the things that occurs. This might be sort of a fun insight. I was 2004. I went to Lockheed Martin to give a talk, and this is kind of crazy, but the reason I gave a talk there is because for years I've been working on little bits and pieces of what's commonly called evolutionary computing platforms or biological metaphors computing. That is systems that will, just like you're saying, act like an organism. They'll evolve. They'll find their own solutions. If there's a failure, they'll sort of figure out their own way around the failure, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lockheed Martin's vision was, well, for obvious reasons, we have an enormous amount of data that we have to protect and all these different industrial processes we manage. What's your take on this? So I gave this two-hour lecture on this thing. Now, everybody in the audience right away got it. This is like 1,000 people. It was a huge auditorium. Nobody there was questioning anything. This is like rote as far as they're concerned. So, I mean, it was kind of obvious that this is kind of where things are going anyway. So the idea of having a self-protective, self-organizing, quasi-organic, like, mechanism, like a nervous system, if you wish, to which we, the humans, are now irreversibly and symbiotically dependent on, yes, I think that
becomes,
model absolutely fits.
Yeah.
So now, if you want to take a look at the war of the future kind of thing, which, sadly, I've spent a fair amount of time looking at,
I mean, the war thing, for our species.
Yeah, well, and just for our survival.
Uh-huh.
The next big thing that's going to happen is probably not going to be bombs and planes. I mean, okay, there will always be that kind of stuff going on. The next big thing is going to be what I call controlled chaos as a commodity. And that is, how do you usurp a nation state's economy to the point where they buckle under and then aren't really able to defend or, you know, function in a normal way? You uproot their infrastructure. You invoke chaos. You invoke panic among the population. I mean, they could, you know, run the banks, and everybody starts hoarding food, and people start getting kind of crazy, et cetera. Well, the pathway for that is to cause a failure on a massive scale on this electronic infrastructure, this nervous system that we're all now so codependent upon.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what's going on. And in fact, there have been a number of different electronic countermeasure and electronic warfare type groups. I've talked to a few of these type folks.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that China, interestingly enough. And I'm not anti-Chinese. I mean, believe me, I love the Chinese culture. I've been very, very enamored of many of the Chinese people here.
Yeah, okay, well, you...
The government, these programs, and they've spent a huge amount of money on this. So, I mean...
Okay, excuse me, Charles. Can you hold on
for
a little break, and then we'll get back to...
Okay, sure.
Yeah, thank you.
KSCO.
I want to say one thing for the phone call. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Just wanted to say one thing, Charles, on some of your hypotheses here. If indeed the internet is an exonervous system for the species, wouldn't it be supporting the overall health of the species? And
that's the theory I've tried to offer sometimes.
And I think
you're very close to the target of where I was hoping to go. And that's a good insight. I like that. It's actually quite appropriate to have that thought.
Thank you. It seemed to me maybe it might collapse governments, but it would protect the people.
Well, no, I'm not sure. This is really funny. The first time I was on the air with Art Bell in 96, believe it or not. In fact, this was right after I was on KCSO, as I recall, a few weeks after or something like that. He asked me, he said, Charles, you're working in artificial life and artificial intelligence and in these self-evolving computer networks and whatever. And he went on. But Charles, what if the machine itself or the network decides on its own where the better pathway might be for the preservation of the, you know, fill in the blank? Yeah. Kind of like in 2001 Space Odyssey when the HAL computer decided they'd been lied to, and they determined that the priority was the mission, not the human beings on board the ship, and you kind of recall what happened.
Exactly, there. Or the day the Earth stood still, part two, you know, the remake.
Exactly. So, I mean, I talk a lot about synthetic sentience as a kind of a concept, but just a few weeks ago, I was actually having another talk with another group, and one of the first things I said was, we probably won't know sentience when it occurs. So this is a weakness we all have. We're all humans, so we take kind of a human-centric view of looking at how other organism types or systems might work. Actually, our view of life is very limited. It's like a little pinhole almost.
Yeah.
I mean,
for our species, yeah.
Exactly. We can only work with what we think we recognize when we've had some kind of experience with.
And what also comes to mind is, wouldn't a synthetic sentience be curious about nature and want to directly connect with it as well as our species?
It depends on what it's exposed to. And when I was talking about evolutionary computing, just a little bit of background, the basic concept of evolutionary computing is to solve problems that are either too complex or too cumbersome to be done through other means. The example I like to always give just for fun, I was at JPL a few years ago as a sort of a demonstration of this concept. Antenna design, speaking of RF and all that, antenna design is a really actually like a black art form. It's a mixture of physics and math and very, very complex science. I know not specialize in that at all. I just know enough about it to know how complex it is.
Yeah.
So they had their own group of engineers trying to build a very, very unusual kind of antenna system for one of their arrays, one of their probes. And they thought, well, okay, let's have one of the evolutionary computing platforms. What is feed it the parameters, it'll evolve its own solution, then we'll have our best engineers design a solution. Okay, fine. So after a few weeks, engineers came back, this little Christmas tree-like rectangle structure, you know, quite pretty, and the EC, or evolution computing platform, evolved what looks like a bird nest, really. It's just this ball of twigs sticking out. Well, the bird nest worked a lot better than the human version, but more importantly, nobody could explain why. And I, this was at the Evolvable Hardware Conference, by the way. And this has been going for years and years. And in many cases, in these extremely complex trading systems on Wall Street, where you have derivatives and all this stuff going on, and certainly in very complex risk analysis, some of the think tank type things that we look at, it's all done with these evolutionary platforms. The humans are like just observers. They're just kind of looking at what
it's already out of control. Oh, by the way, we have a comment from the chat room.
Okay, sure.
Mihai's asking, he said, yeah, perhaps the Chinese, maybe other agent groups, and he'd like a little bit more of a discussion
on that.
Okay,
sure. That's fine.
How about we take a phone call,
too? A phone call as well?
Yeah.
Okay, can you multitask here, Charles?
Sure, by all means, go for it.
All right, I'm going to take you a call,
This is Phil in Santa Cruz. Welcome, Phil.
Hey, Phil.
Oh, hi. I had a couple quick questions.
Sure.
The first one is if he thinks the Chinese are more technologically advanced than we are, or if they're the second most technologically advanced country, or if they're somewhere else in the mix.
I would go somewhere else because their objectives are somewhat different. And it's a very good question. I want to be very respectful and try to give you the best answer I'm capable of delivering. We view, just like I was saying to Alan on the air, we tend to view things through the lens of what we're familiar with. In the Chinese culture, though, at least for those that are in this realm, their reality is quite different. For them, a multi-generational 50-year plan is normal. I mean, that's just kind of how their dynastic world works. We don't live in that kind of world. We live in a very short-term, sort of instantaneous, real-time, you know, election cycle kind of driven economic system world. So the worldview is very different, and therefore the strategies for approaching certain objectives might be very different. If you're talking about who has the better technology, it kind of breaks down as define the technology. I don't mean to be coy. I'm just saying it depends on what your end goal really is or what your long-term strategy is. What the Chinese have done, and I think they're remarkably good about this, they A, lured us into debt that we can never get out of. We can't possibly pay back the debt we already owe. This is a long story, and it's probably too long to go into here right now, but, you know, they played that game very well. Meanwhile, Russia, which has been recovering, and China have been sort of quasi-partisan crime, and marriage of convenience, that kind of thing, and they very cleverly were able to harvest the very best of the Russian scientists in the areas that they wanted to harvest. And because they now have the upper hand in controlling our economy, which they do, and the European economy is sort of in the same basket, really, they can just pick and choose the things that are most relevant to them. So, in other words, if you wanted to get a broad spectrum, like who has the most robust technology, I would say we still do. But in terms of those technologies which fit a very special or very particular set of agendas, it could be that the Chinese are very close, if not already passed.
And the next question is more specific. There was a submarine missile launch right off the coast of California, a little bit north of Catalina. The government said it was a contrail, but I saw the videos, and it's an insult to the intelligence.
Yeah.
What do you think that was, and if it was Chinese, why did they do it so everyone could see it?
Because they want everybody to see it. Now, a couple of quick things, but those are good, excellent questions, and I wish I had more time to, because it's the kind of talk I like to do. You may recall a while ago when, as a demonstration, China shot down one of their old weather satellites. Hey, look, we can do this. It's like, okay, fine. Mm-hmm. And then we shot down one of ours as a kind of a tit for tat. Okay, fine.
Isn't that one of the things that the space station just avoided?
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, the deal is, even when I was in SDI, we knew this was going to be around the corner. Even if the Soviet Union fell apart, we visualized that China or somebody would come up with the next thing. So even back then, it was kind of this is the beginning edge of the next thing that the world was going to be facing. And just as a personal note, I hate the idea of weaponizing space. It really, to me, is a very sad outcome of our species, of our planet. I mean, speaking of us as an organism, this is just the wrong way to go completely. But unfortunately, it's just going to go that way. So every so often, they pull out one of theirs, and then we pull out one of ours. It's a kind of a game. That's how I see it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Good. Thanks a lot, Phil, for calling in.
So we have a question about the Chinese and hacking.
Yes.
Now, you say that there's a preponderance of intelligence.
More than preponderance. It's like overtly, blaringly obvious. And that's where I was hoping to go a few minutes ago. Thanks for circling back.
Mm-hmm.
The People's Daily, that's the officially sanctioned government-authorized newspaper of China, the journal that says this is where we are today, they published, I mean, this is through government-authorized release, that they were announcing a new branch of their military, just like a Navy or an Army or whatever, the Cyber Army, with pride. I mean, they clearly made it a big announcement. Now, in reality, they have tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, if not more. I mean, it's an unknown number, but it's an enormous number of people who are highly educated, many of whom came to our schools, like UC Berkeley, for instance, came back to China, and they're very good. I mean, this is the one area that they really excel in, is this kind of technology, you know, understanding how to use it. And they have made a 24/7, no holds barred, cost is no barrier attempt to probe every single firewall, every single system, every single major network they can possibly get into, and they have probed, and they have probed again. They keep coming back. It's really kind of something. Now, we, of course, have had our teams of people responding, and kind, and the ARPs got their teams, and if anything, it's kind of forced everybody to take a much more serious look at what really is going to happen and how can we defend for this. So maybe in a sense, kind of like evolutionary processes being a trauma-induced mechanism, they were, you know, finally responding, developing a more serious view of this. But in fact, it's been very consistent. And if one wanted to follow this model a little bit further, and if there was going to be a next stage in some kind of covert Cold War / economic warfare, you know, that kind of thing, it would be through this mechanism. You'd have failures, you'd have sudden, mysteriously, industrial accidents going on, your banking system would suddenly freeze up, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean,
that's pretty profound. I mean, first there's the Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines. Now there's the Cyber Corps.
Correct. And it's the only country in the world that actually has a declared Cyber Corps. Now, we do have, in their various branches here of the military, we have our own separate little groups, and they're all sort of merging together. But for China to have come out with a statement that bold, in the People's Daily, it's kind of like a big middle finger saying, okay, I don't care if you like this or not. This is us. This is what we're doing. It's kind of brazen. I mean, I give them credit for big gonads.
So how would you identify a major state attack like that as compared to the usual hacker attack?
These are really sophisticated. It used to be back in the old days, Captain Crunch, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like a lone hacker or a couple of kids trying to get their way into the phone system to get free phone calls, you know, and then later it was like to steal computer games, that kind of thing.
It's kiddie scripts.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. But now it's gotten much more sophisticated to the extent where long-term Trojan horses that can be broken into small pieces that lie around different sections of a network, and then when the right signal goes out, they all of a sudden congeal and form into this sort of massive, you know, failure system.
Right, or the Stuxnet virus.
Exactly so. And it's becoming, this has gone to a level of complexity that, interestingly enough, evolutionary computing might be the only answer for it. In other words, it's gone beyond the world of some folks in a room somewhere typing code and seeing if they can figure out a way to respond to this. It may have to be that a quasi-sentient-like response is the only thing that allows for the system to go on in perpetuity.
That the internet immune system would just start to deal with these things.
Exactly right. And so is there a profound shift of consciousness, if I can use that set of words, getting away from the old-school world of a bunch of coders writing code and then testing it out and seeing where the thing breaks, as opposed to allowing a quasi-sentient-like entity that sort of controls its own health, as it were, and has its own immune system, to let that become the new thing. Mm-hmm. And then we are sort of involuntarily adapted to it. The Skynet version of what happened in the Terminator, that sort of thing,
yes.
That was sort of the premise of it.
Yes.
Well, are we there yet? Not exactly, but are the pieces of the puzzle sort of getting there, possibly?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if we see more of these consistent attacks and very serious efforts with, you know, thousands of organized hackers as a military project constantly probing all of our systems, I think there will be a decision made at some point saying,
well,
it's a policy matter, that's where you have to go.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. But now let me ask you this. Now, if any chance that it's beginning to perceive itself as being alive in some way, if you had a focus on, say, an internet kill switch, wouldn't it react to that?
Well, that's a very good question. And the reason I brought up Art Bell is because when he was on the air and I was talking to him, he said, but Charles, if evolutionary computing platforms learn from what they see, they're going to, on their own, determine what their best choice of options is. And I said, that's exactly right. Whatever they see is what they will learn from. So in other words, if they see a dark, ominous, sort of evilish, I'm trying to use the right set of words, you know, kind of environment that they have to be very specific in how they respond to, that's the mentality that they will develop.
Hmm.
So in a sense, the sentient entity that evolves, that we may not even know is sentient, it will emerge because of what it's been exposed to. And that's like a real test of consciousness, because if all of it sees around it is this sort of dark, competitive, predatory, I will kill you before you kill me kind of attitude, it itself will become that way.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if the human participants have a much more open-minded, how would you use the term, instead of weaponry, I forget the term you use, but you know, a sort of a pro-healthy planet kind of way of looking at things,
mm-hmm.
then that would be the orientation of the sentient entity. It will adapt to whatever.
So it's up to us to give it a direction still.
That would be hopefully so, yeah.
Yeah, and how would we do that? I mean,
it's hard to say. Now, here's the kind of wild card in all this. You've got lots of people out there who have, in fact, used the internet for their own independence. I mean, I look at things like what happened in Iran and Middle East, where the people in the street were using Twitter and so forth as their tool to kind of develop their own freedom.
Yes.
That's interesting. I mean, I find that really fascinating.
Yes, and in this country, universities are putting all their courses online so
exactly
that anyone
right.
can get an education.
That level of humanity from all over the planet who are not looking to kill or cause harm, but rather to say we want to be free, we want to have a better planet,
mm-hmm.
maybe the system might actually interpret that as some kind of a value that it can incorporate into its emerging mm-hmm. sentience.
So
I have
it.
A question
yeah,
for
please,
you here, Charles. So
go for it.
In this emerging information universe, what is the new prime directive, do you think? How should our designers be directing the future cybernetic intelligence that is beyond our control?
Well, that's a very tricky question, because once again, the prime directive is only what we see at this current moment in time. I mean, I often talk about ET. That's another thing I spend a lot of time on,
mm-hmm.
because I think that we're probably are being observed, and I think for a variety of reasons, but they're not really going to help us. Just want to see what happens as a sort of a cautionary thing. I think if anything, a prime directive would be sort of something along those lines, kind of more like, rather than trying to influence in advance, have some kind of a way of at least understanding what it sees. If you can recognize its sentience, at least have a handle on that. Because I don't think we're going to be able to tell when it first happens.
Well, let's see, Charles. We're about to wind down. We're in our last 30 seconds here. You have any parting words of optimistic wisdom?
I wake up every morning, I see sunlight, and I'm thankful for it. But, you know, here's the deal. Look, I tend to think that this model has been done many times in many worlds.
Yeah.
We're at one of those crucial tipping points, just like many of the worlds have already gone through.
Yeah.
I hope we make it. I think there's a lot of good potential people who are trying to.
Sounds like we should be careful what we wish for and assume we're going to get it.
Who
knows?
Use the net for
thanks,
good stuff.
Charles.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Mr. Osman.
Thank you.
Thank you, KSCO, for listening. KSCO.com, Santa Cruz.